It started out sunny, then it looked very overcast, and it was going to rain. In fact, I forgot my umbrella in court because I thought it was going to rain, and then when I came out, it was sunny, and luckily I remembered. Not that that's significant to anybody other than me. But tomorrow, there are areas of frost in the morning, and then sunny, high of about 62 degrees. So tonight they said low. We can expect about 36 degrees, and of course freezing, it's 32, but there can be frost between 36 and 32 degrees. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy, higher temperature, about 43 degrees would be the low. And by Sunday, there's a slight chance of rain, about a 20% chance. So if you haven't gotten all your plants in, anybody who wants to salvage any for the winter should do that, if possible, tomorrow. And if you can't get it done tomorrow, do it on Sunday. Monday is mostly sunny, high of about 68 degrees, mostly cloudy Monday night, low of about 52 degrees. And for the rest of the week, Tuesday, there's a 60% chance of showers, so that's pretty likely. And also the same thing on Tuesday night. But tonight is the only night that it should be dipping down to give us some frost. At least that's the prediction. So we're going to be with you on the program It's the Law. And I'll be back as soon as I give you a couple brief announcements from our sponsors.
Are you looking to get your message in front of a qualified audience through all the noise out there today? Consider taking an advertisement out on Hunterdon Chamber Radio, WHCR-DB, the voice of business. Contact the Chamber today at 908-782-7115 or give us an email at info@hunterdon-chamber.org.
I'm Andy Ross. I'm chairman of the Ambassadors Committee of the Chamber. As members of the Ambassadors Committee, we contact new and renewing members of the Chamber to get their feedback on their Chamber experience and make them feel more at home with the Chamber.
Hunterdon Chamber of Commerce, building business, one business at a time.
Hello again, this is Pat Smits and the program It's the Law. Wanted to talk to you today about some of the cases and some of the things that are important or at least pending in lawsuits and different decisions. And I also wanted to talk somewhat about what we call the law of domestic, what we call quadros and in the business, QDRO. This law is specific to the division of retirement accounts limited to private companies. It doesn't involve retirement under the military, under the state, so that certainly the police department, their pensions are not covered by what we call quadro law or ERISA. ERISA is the federal statute. So I will be talking about that because I've had a number of questions recently, and it's a confusing area. So the first thing, though, I wanted to talk a little bit about is some of the things that are going on. There, as far as cases, approved for publication, of course, means that they're precedent-setting. If they're not approved for publication, they're, of course, of interest, but they are not something that we can use in court. However, there was a reminder that, sometimes you win, and the trial judge in all cases, even if you lose, certainly on a procedural issue, there are times where that is not going to be accepted by the appellate division, so that there was a situation where the court, a plaintiff, fired the attorney and also filed an ethics complaint against the attorney. The attorney had refused to turn over escrowed funds to the plaintiff, as required by the court. And so then what happened is the court gave the plaintiff 2 weeks to retain a new attorney and then dismissed the complaint when the plaintiff had not retained a new attorney. And so that is the court said, wait a minute, I'm going to dismiss the complaint for lack of prosecution. So the interesting part about that and why the appellate division reversed is the plaintiff corporation's sole shareholders were both over the age of 80, and one of them became seriously ill after the attorney was removed, and the other shareholder had to care for him, probably his wife. I think it was his wife. So she timely contacted an attorney to take over the case, but the attorney was unable to do so. Then 2 months later, she found an attorney who filed to reinstate the complaint. So she was out of time based on the order. And what happened is she had the attorney file a motion asking the court to reinstate the complaint and giving reasons why she could not have complied with the two-week two-week order. And the defendant in that case did not respond. So then there was an appeal, and so because the trial court found that the plaintiff did not establish good cause in order to give more time to allow the plaintiffs to reinstate the complaint. So the in this case, the appellate court, when there was an appeal, found that the motion judge, meaning the trial judge, ignored the extraordinary personal issues faced by the plaintiff's shareholders, meaning that one of them became seriously ill and the other had to take care of them. And so the appellate division said, wait a minute, the trial judge also failed to address the fact that the defendant did not respond to the motion. So in this case, the defendant, that was significant, that the defendant did not respond to the motion to say why it would be prejudicial to the defendant if this complaint was reinstated 2 months after it should have been. And so that the appellate court agreed that there was an error by the trial judge in exercising her discretion and the fact that she did not consider all of the facts presented that demonstrated good cause. So in other words, in this case, based on good cause, the trial judge should have allowed the plaintiffs to reinstate their complaint and did not. So they were now able to do that. There was a family law case where the plaintiff was a grandmother and she appealed from a denial of her application for joint legal custody and temporary physical custody of her grandchildren. This case, along with others, confirms that as long as a parent was fit to parent children, in this case the mother, then the plaintiff grandmother did not satisfy the analysis used when a third party seeks complaint over a natural parent. And actually, in this case, the defendant mother voluntarily gave temporary custody of the children to the grandmother. And then a year later, when the plaintiff filed for joint legal custody, residential custody, and visitation, that's when the issue came up, and the plaintiff testified at the hearing that she had not wanted to keep the children permanently and return them to the mother when the mother's financial situation improved. That's why the mother asked the grandmother to care for the children. So at that point, the plaintiff's grandmother's application was denied because the trial judge determined that the mother was a fit parent for the children, had adequate living accommodations, had secured a school, and daycare arrangements for them. So it is very difficult for a grandparent to win custody when a parent objects. And that's really the moral of this, that grandparent rights are very limited. They really are, based on trial courts in New Jersey, Moriarty, and the U.S. Supreme Court, so that there's just a very tough road. And if, in fact, the children are with the grandparents based on DCP&P placing them there, I suggest that the grandparents, instead of seeking custody themselves, they go back and allow DCP&P to terminate parent rights. But in this case, the grandmother simply said, look, I will take care of the children until you're in a financial position to do so. And when she tried to get that enforced by the court, all the mother had to do was show that, in fact, she was fit, had a place for the children, they could go to school, etc. So people who are interested in the J&J suits, the what we call the talcum powder suits, there was a $110 million talcum powder suit verdict that was reversed when it was appealed in Missouri. So that was very significant for J&J. There's also a proof for publication, a civil rights and education law case that's really rather interesting. This case, the plaintiff appealed from the dismissal of his complaint against the defendant. The plaintiff was an individual. The defendant was a private for-profit corporation that operated private schools, including a facility in New Jersey that operated a day program for children. And that program is for children 6 weeks through 6 years. Now, the child in this case, and they identify as MM, had Down syndrome. And she was enrolled in this facility in its infant program. Now, and they kept her, of course, in the infant program, and the infant program provided diapering services. But once she progressed through the program to what was called an intermediate program, that program did not provide diapering services. And although the defendant facility advised MM's parents that she would need to be potty trained, her pediatrician advised MM's parents that she would need to be potty trained. However, that because of her developmental delays would prevent her from being fully potty trained until age 5 or older. So therefore, she was not eligible for this program. However, although the defendant advised MM's parents that she would need to be potty trained, as I said, the pediatrician said her developmental delays would not allow that, and the facility said she could not participate in the intermediate program because of this. So what happened in this is the defendant ultimately disenrolled MM. In other words, she was no longer eligible to participate in that program. So what her parents did is they filed a complaint with the Division of Civil Rights, alleging that the defendant discriminated against MM due to her Down syndrome. And, of course, the Division of Civil Rights, they have significant powers to deal with people with handicaps. So after substantiating the charges, the plaintiff filed a complaint with the court, and with respect to the child not being able to attend the program. So the trial court granted summary judgment to the defendant. That means without going further, they agreed with the defendant to dismiss the case. And the trial court ruled that the plaintiff lacked authority to even file a complaint for compensatory damages for a non-party private citizens. It's because MM's parents were not aggrieved. They were not considered the aggrieved persons under the New Jersey law against discrimination, against that law. And that the statute did not recognize a cause of action for refusing to do business based on a customer's disability. So, in other words, they said, the parents can't file, the trial judge said, parents cannot file this complaint because although you're the customers, you're filing it based on your child. Now, the trial court further ruled that the plaintiff could not seek permanent injunctive relief. And on appeal, the appellate court affirmed the grant of summary judgment. So they agreed with the trial court that the child in this case, MM, if she wasn't potty trained by age 5, she could not participate in the program. So the court, in this case, the appellate court, in this case, it was the parent, and so that the appellate court ruled that a complainant authorized to file a complaint, that in this time, it was not the plaintiff. They did not have any right, or he did not have any right to file the complaint, because the court ruled that a complainant authorized to file a complaint could, in this case, not include the child's father, because including the father's child as a complainant would mean that the plaintiff would have to be statutorily required to seek permission to file suit from its own agency. So that's a real problem, because they said that the Division of Civil Rights could not, in other words, little confusing, but that their authority did not include the plaintiff, since the plaintiff would not be able to be so designated. And they also held that the court, the appellate division, held that the plaintiff did not have authority to file suit under the doctrine of parens patriae, because the New Jersey law against discrimination gave those who had been unlawfully discriminated against a means to protect themselves. So in other words, the parents were not able to proceed in that case. The daycare was, in fact, able to disenroll this child. A federal judge in Newark ordered a snack food maker to pay a $33,000 sanction to a rival company after it produced a newly amended report moments before the scheduled deposition. Huge sanction. The governors of former governors of Delaware and two former state Supreme Court chief justices are urging the U.S. Supreme Court to review a federal appellate court decision that ruled unconstitutional a judicial appointment process that effectively limits service on the bench to Republicans and Democrats. And this sounds like another, you know, kind of gotcha. So one of the things that we really have to be careful out there, and we all have to be careful, but apparently by February 2017, tax reforms for hundreds of current and former Jenner and Block employees fell in the wrong hands, and potentially exposing their private addresses, social security numbers, and salary information. So that so more than 100 law firms have reported data breaches, and the problem is just getting worse. I mean, this is really significant. It's you can't respond any longer to anyone, unless you absolutely know their name and their email address, because otherwise, not saying it's fair or not, but otherwise, you can, you can be held responsible. Let's, I see that there should be a couple more spots that we play, so let's do that, and then I'll come back and perhaps talk about the ERISA one more time.
You're listening to WHCR-DB, HunterdonChamberRadio.com, brought to you by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
I'm Andy Ross. I'm chairman of the Ambassadors Committee of the Chamber. As members of the Ambassadors Committee, we contact new and renewing members of the Chamber to get their feedback on their Chamber experience and make them feel more at home with the Chamber.
When it matters most, our award-winning team of emergency physicians and nurses provide sophisticated care 24 hours a day. Superior emergency care at a moment's notice. Hunterdon Healthcare, your full circle of care.
I'm Andy Ross. I'm chairman of the Ambassadors Committee of the Chamber. As members of the Ambassadors Committee, we contact new and renewing members of the Chamber to get their feedback on their Chamber experience and make them feel more at home with the Chamber.
Hunterdon Chamber of Commerce, building business, one business at a time.
Sabía que de cada 5 personas hay una que lucha con síntomas difíciles de salud mental. NAMI es una organización estatal sin fines de lucro. Somos empleados voluntarios. Somos la voz de la nación sobre las enfermedades mentales. NAMI te ofrece grupos de apoyo, educación e información. Nuestro programa educativo de Familia a Familia está dirigido por miembros de NAMI para familiares y amigos de personas que luchan con dificultad de salud mental. Llámanos al 888-803-3413. Recuerda, no estás solo. NAMI está contigo y no hay salud sin salud mental.
Okay, back with a couple more cases, and I will talk about Division of Pensions under ERISA. Couple things that seem to be somewhat of interest, and one of the things that I get a lot of questions about are concerns about restraining orders under the Prevention of Domestic Violence Act. So I just wanted to talk to you about a couple of those recently. But before that, I think this is either humorous or I can't believe somebody would do that. And that is a state appeals court upheld the criminal conviction of a man for public communication of obscenity. So what happened in that case is he was arrested for viewing pornography in his car parked outside a restaurant with the windows rolled down. And the charge was public communication of obscenity And that was the charge, and he was convicted, and the appellate division upheld his conviction. So, I mean, who knows why anyone would be so stupid to be watching porn in his car in a parking lot in front of a restaurant. I guess we could assume that maybe he was hoping that someone else would see it. Who knows? But, you know, this goes in my binder of, hey, how could anybody be so stupid? But what I wanted to talk about with respect to the prevention of domestic violence is this is a case where a defendant appealed from the final restraining order. This was entered against her. The defendant was the niece, and the plaintiff was her uncle. And what happened is the parties had lived together for 6 or 7 years, but that was approximately 28 years ago. Now, at the time of the incident, this is what we're talking about, the incident that gave rise to the domestic violence order. So at the time of the incident giving rise to the final restraining order, the plaintiff lived around the corner from the house where the defendant resided with the plaintiff's mother. So the plaintiff was her uncle and his mother, so her great aunt, it was where she was residing. So during the incident, the plaintiff visited the residence to see his mother, and she was expected to return from a rehabilitation facility. Now, while the plaintiff waited outside, he alleged that the defendant pulled up in her vehicle and began verbally assaulting him. And the defendant entered the residence and then came back outside with a piece of lumber and struck the plaintiff's car with it. And at that point, now we're talking about the uncle. So his niece came, entered the residence, and came back outside with a piece of lumber and struck his truck with it. So at that point, the plaintiff returned home, and he alleged that later that day, the niece arrived at the plaintiff uncle's home with her son, who forcefully entered the house and engaged in a physical altercation with the uncle. Now, some family. While the defendant at the same time began breaking the plaintiff's windows. So the defendant offered a different view of the, or a different version, I guess I should say, of the events. She testified that she had accused plaintiff of stealing his mother's checks and denied striking the plaintiff's truck or breaking the windows of his house. However, the trial court entered a final restraining order, finding plaintiff's testimony credible. In other words, he listened and heard the uncle's testimony and found that credible, and noting that the defendant acknowledged an ongoing dispute between the parties, which supported the uncle's fear that the defendant would take action against him. On appeal, the defendant, remember, she did not get the restraining order. She did get the restraining order entered against her, and she argued that there was insufficient evidence to find the predicate act of criminal mischief or that the plaintiff needed the protection of a final restraining order. So there's two things. Even if you're found guilty of the underlying offense, if there's no need to provide a final restraining order, then it should not be granted. For example, I've seen situations where somebody is in prison for a long time, and then the question will be, even though they did commit the domestic violence, was it enough to enter an FRO since there'd be no chance of them having contact? So that was, the court rejected the defendant's argument. This is on appeal. The court rejected the defendant's arguments and affirmed noting that the plaintiff's credible testimony supported a finding that the predicate act of criminal mischief did not happen, and also certain other things that are not really that relevant here. The main thing is, here this was the parties, there was jurisdiction under the court rules and under the statute because the parties at one point had lived together. And that's what gave the court jurisdiction. And then, of course, there was, the incident of that occurred between the plaintiff and defendant. But if that incident had occurred and the parties had never lived together, they would not be able to proceed under statute for domestic violence. And most properly, because it's limited to people who have lived together. But the question has been for years, should it be available to somebody who hasn't lived with the alleged perpetrator for 20 or 30 years or more? So there is a second, that one was JH versus CH, that case, just reported, I believe it was Thursday. In any event, that case, it was the second case. Again, defendant appealed from the grant of a final restraining order in favor of the plaintiff. Now, the plaintiff was the defendant's former husband. And what happened in this case is that was ordered. She was ordered to pay attorney's fees because in support of a restraining order, the victim can, in fact, ask for legal fees. So in support of his request for a restraining order, the former husband alleged that the defendant, his former wife, had become upset about the loss of child support. And this was child support for the party's son, who had just graduated from high school and was emancipated. So the what happened is the former husband alleged that the former wife defendant began texting and email, sending not only texting, she sent emails to plaintiff despite his request that she cease and dismiss. Mm-hmm. So that wouldn't have been... doesn't happen a lot, but happens enough. So that it is important to make sure. I always say it's not a bad idea for someone to have a little tape recorder in their pocket. And if they're going to record information for court, I think I'd have to take it. So, what else is happening here? Well, let me tell you a little bit more about what's happening in some news. And then the weather is still the same, as I reported earlier. And the news just is slowly, I'm having some trouble getting it on, so let me see if I can.
USA Radio News with Tim Berg.
The Justice Department announced on Friday that they've set a record over the last year in prosecuting more criminal cases against illegal immigrants and migrant smugglers than any year on record. The numbers are still a tiny fraction of the overall illegal activity at the border, with nearly 1 million unauthorized crosses in fiscal year 2019. The government only charged about 106,000 people with either illegal entry or illegal reentry after a previous deportation. House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy is satisfied with acting White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney's clarification regarding his comments about the president and Ukraine.
Well, I think what Mick clarified in his statement was very clear. I watched in all those transcripts of what people have been saying inside the investigation, Volcker and others, there was no quid pro quo.
And you're listening to USA Radio News.
If this were just any door, and this were just any ignition, connected to just any transmission, in just any vehicle, then perhaps it would be okay to buy it from just anyone. But this is not just any car. It's a certified pre-owned Mercedes-Benz. Every detail has been inspected and road tested by highly skilled Mercedes-Benz technicians. And it's all backed by an unlimited mileage warranty, which makes the decision of where to buy one simple. Your authorized Mercedes-Benz dealer. The certified pre-owned sales event going on now through October 31st. Come in today and enjoy a credit of up to $1,500 towards your first two payments through Mercedes-Benz Financial Services. Because in the end, it's absolute confidence in genuine Mercedes-Benz parts, or it isn't. It's either Mercedes-Benz certified pre-owned, or it isn't.
See your authorized Mercedes-Benz dealer for complete details and limitations on credit towards your first 2 months payment and certified pre-owned warranties.
Okay, back after that news break, and I'm not going to comment about the million people who are coming across the border, other than to say one of the significant reasons in Guatemala, where I lived for 2 years, is not only the gangs, but the absolute lack of food because of the drought. And so these lush areas, there's so much drought that people cannot raise the basic, corn, which goes into tortillas, and beans, and the staple in the diet in Guatemala are tortillas and beans. So that I honestly believe that in some of the areas, not the ones where there's so much gang activity and the people are really being killed. I know of personal instances where people have been killed, and that's one of the reasons the kids are coming here, the teenagers are coming here, because there's no one who can take care of them in Guatemala and no one who is taking care of them, and they're being constantly threatened by the gangs. And the gangs are seeking recruitment, and if these young people do not join the gangs, they or their families are going to be killed, and that's happening. But in any event, so I'm just commenting on that news, and if the only 106 illegal people with illegal entries or illegal reentry are being charged, that's pretty incredible small numbers, small percentage. And of course, what the number, and they didn't provide the number in the news, of the number who of the 106 who are re-entering after they've been deported back. We don't know what number that is. So very, very difficult problem. It's not going to be solved easily. I certainly don't believe that a wall is going to prevent immigration. It just won't. And walls in other parts of the world, including that famous Maginot Line, including the wall that separated East Berlin and West Berlin, that didn't prevent people from, coming over to the side, our side, in all of those cases. So back to family law. People need to be very careful about their actions because folks are now going to file domestic restraining orders. And so this is a case that I wanted to tell you about, even though it's not published. It's really, I won't say typical, but this kind of thing can happen so often. So in this case, there was a prevention of domestic violence The court ordered that and a final restraining order in favor of the plaintiff, who was the defendant's former husband, and also awarded him legal fees. But that's important. It was the plaintiff's former husband. So it was the man that she had been married to. Now, in support of the request for a restraining order, the plaintiff alleged that the defendant had become upset about the fact that his child support award for the party's son was actually eliminated because the son had graduated from high school and was now emancipated. So the plaintiff alleged that this is the father and the former husband, that the defendant began texting and emailing the plaintiff. And so that we have to look at, because it's pretty easy today to, do this, to text or email someone before you recognize that you need to read it, you need to think about it, etc. So the plaintiff's former husband did object, and he requested that she cease and contact, and then found out that his former wife began taking photos, so that was significant. That's the second thing. He began taking those photographs. So that was all significant. And so the trial court in that case entered a final restraining order, finding that the plaintiff had met his burden of proof, that he had established the defendant committed what we talk about, the current act and the predicate act. In this case, that the predicate act would have been her inclusion. Well, actually, let me think about that. The trial court found that she had, in fact, committed violence based on her allegations. I'm hesitating, but I shouldn't. It filed a restraining order that in the past. But what happened here is a trial court did enter a final restraining order and held that the plaintiff, the former wife, was going to be restrained, found that the plaintiff had met his burden of there's some silence here because of people coming in and out. I apologize. So the trial court entered a final restraining order, finding that the plaintiff had not met his burden of proof to establish that the defendant committed the predicate act of harassment. And found, I should say that he did, that the judge did find that, and found the plaintiff continued to fear the defendant. He had to have a police escort, or at least he recognized one and requested one. On appeal, however, the defendant argued that the trial court appellate division agreed with the defendant's challenge to the sufficiency of the evidence and reversed the entry of the final restraining order and reversed the award of attorney fees. So the court then, as I said, reversed the entry of the FRO and found evidence that did not support the defendant's engagement in a course of alarming conduct. So that was the situation here. That said that the court noted the defendant never threatened the plaintiff's safety, security, or privacy. So you have to be very careful because it could have been different, but he didn't do that by taking photographs of him, or she didn't do it by taking photographs of him in public or sending rude emails. The court held that the trial court failed to find that an FRO was necessary. So that's important. Actually, that's very important because you have to have a finding of a predicate act and a finding of harassment or some other statutory way to grant the grant the FRO. Well, it looks like I only have a few more minutes, but let me talk about ERISA. ERISA, E-R-I-S-A, is a federal statute, and it was enacted to make sure that companies who offer pension plans will, in fact, have the plan available when people retire. So it's generally the initials E-R-I-S-A, ERISA, is what we use for in this case. So the ERISA is a statute that is used to determine how pensions, private pensions, can be divided. And the reason for that is there's an exception in ERISA that allows a spouse, a former spouse, to be covered under those plans, or if they're transferred to an IRA, for example. And that is significant because the ERISA statute, before it was amended, did not contain that kind of language. So what happens is there is when you're dividing a retirement account, and when I say you have to think of this as limited to private companies, not covered, there's a separate statute with respect to the state and state workers, and of course there are different rules that are affected if it's a police officer. But in any event, the participant in the plan is the employee, and that this employee whose name was maintained on the records. There's also an alternate payee, and the alternate payee is the former spouse, the child, or other dependent upon the plaintiff. And then the qualified domestic relations order, or QDRO, is technically an order used to divide an ERISA-based retirement plan, even though that term is often used liberally and incorrectly. So there are some preliminary questions that have to be answered, and then depending on the type of plan, it depends on the type of plan to find out when it must be and ordered properly. So that is the, there are two kinds of plans, of course. There's a defined contribution plan, and that's when the valuing of the defined contribution plan, it needs to be, sometimes it needs to be updated. Sometimes they're just going to want to put the language together and wait to file it. I don't mean wait a long time, but I just mean wait so that other documents can be used. So generally, it's not possible to exactly state what a member's benefits will be as of his date or her date of retirement. Now, that's not possible while the employee is still employed. However, the percentage can easily be put in, and that would be the percentage of the years worked at whatever corporation we're talking about, divided by the total number of years. Now, do I have that mixed up? I'm sorry if I do. But in other words, if you were married for 10 years and you work for 20 years, the spouse would be entitled to one quarter. That's one quarter, each spouse, one quarter, and then the wife. So there are two kinds of plans. There's a defined contribution plan, and so the value in a defined contribution plan, it must be very precise as to the date on which the account is to be valued, because even the time during the day, because markets fluctuate throughout the day. And so the defined benefit plans, that plan sometimes will provide valuations. The other thing with the defined contribution plans, often they're not broken up and distributed. Now, the plans that are the defined benefit plans, the defined contribution plans, there are differences, because in the defined contribution plans, you know how much is in that account as of a certain day. With a defined benefit plan, you're really not going to know until the young man, young woman leaves the company or changes the insurance. But right now, it would certainly be foolish for you to do something like that. So my suggestion always is, don't change it, and don't change anything that could fluctuate, at least, I think that'll get into too much. So that is significant in a divorce, because all assets acquired during the marriage, including retirement plans, 401ks, any type of deferred compensation, if it has not totally been paid out, needs to be valued, or at least in the pot for distribution. And interestingly, I've had cases where there was no, there's just no question that there were retirement plans in many of these . But what we didn't find is perhaps anything specific, certainly not to day and price. It was often just, everybody's supposed to review their information. And I'm trying to speak deliberately, because the importance is that what parents usually do, people usually do, is, let's say, everybody's getting paperwork from various attorneys. They need to make some decisions, and so what we have is, for Exhibit A, is the evaluation of defined contribution. Well, actually, I think I'm about done for today. If nothing else, I am going to be falling asleep any minute here. So let me play the news, couple spots from our sponsors, and then we'll be back with the sports guys.
Home Instead Senior Care. It's our passionate dedication to creating personal relationships between our clients and our caregivers. Visit our website at www.homeinstead.com/325.
You've got a friend.
Everybody over there!
Get on up!
Everybody out there!
Get into it!
Everybody right there!
Get involved!
Everybody, you!
D
Did you know? The Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce has over 20 active committees that you can participate in. Committees range from focus on business and government to economic development to events like our annual business expo. Contact the Chamber for more information today at 908-782-7115 or email us at info@hunterdon-chamber.org. The Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, USA, the voice of business.
USA Radio News with Tim Berg.
President Trump will nominate Deputy Energy Secretary Dan Brulette as the new Secretary of Energy. Trump tweeted that Brulette's experience in the energy sector is unparalleled. President Trump also thanked outgoing Energy Secretary Rick Perry, who plans to exit at the end of the year. Also at the White House on Friday, President Trump talking to reporters about a possible trade deal with China.
We're working with China very well. We've done, subject to getting it signed, and I think it will get signed quite easily, hopefully by the summit in Chile, where President Xi and I will both be.
The president says he hopes to have a trade deal done with China within the month. And your final numbers on Wall Street, the Dow lost 255 points to close the week at 26,770. The S&P lost 11 to close at 29,86. And you're listening to USA Radio News.
So there's this guy named Jordan, and he's a healthy guy. He's a dad of six, and he works as a guide in Alaska. But then he goes to the doctor, and he's diagnosed with cancer, stage four. And here's the thing. He had switched from medical insurance to MediShare, which is a Christian healthcare sharing ministry. So the question for Jordan and his wife Jenny was, is this really going to work?
Our medical bills exceeded $160,000. MediShare members shared all our bills.
And it was about more than just the money, too. This is a real community.
MediShare is a family, a group of people that stick with you through the hardest times of your life. I just don't know how I could have done it without MediShare.
It's so worth looking into. There's a reason this is growing so fast. If you want to find out more, here's a number for you. 833-34-BIBLE. That's 833-34-BIBLE. 833-34-BIBLE.
A teacher strike continues in Chicago. USA Radio Network's Chris Barnes has more on the story.
Chicago public classrooms will be empty again today. It's day two of a Chicago teachers union strike. 32,000 teachers and aides walking picket lines. The Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot says that it means classes will be canceled until the strike ends, as teachers are striking over pay and benefits, class sizes, teacher prep time. They also want more support staff like nurses, librarians, counselors, and school psychologists.
Striking General Motors workers say they won't go back to work until they vote to approve a new tentative contract. The nearly 50,000 GM workers have been on strike for more than a month and will start voting on the deal this weekend. The United Auto Workers Union has set a deadline of October 25th to have all those ballots turned in. The strike has cost General Motors over $1 billion. And you're listening to USA Radio News.
Friends and family, I've told you about the great sleep I get with my MyPillow every night. Well, right now, you can get a great deal and extra safety, because if you go to MyPillow.com, click on the Radio Listener Special, get their buy one, get one free offer on the MyPillow Premium Pillow. Your 60-day money-back guarantee goes all the way through March 1st, 2020. That's now through December 25th. When you go to MyPillow.com, click on the Radio Listener Special and use my promo code USA.
Giving every American adult between $1,000 and $5,000 may sound like a gimmick or too good to be true. But according to Democratic presidential candidate Andrew Yang, it's a deeply American idea dating back centuries. Yang and other presidential candidates have floated the idea but have given very few specifics on how this would be paid for. Former Dirty Jobs host Mike Rowe joins Fox News and says we're going down quite a slippery slope when we start handing out free money.
You can't ignore the human condition.
Right.
We're fundamentally lazy people.
Mm-hmm.
We have to be taught, I think, to not be lazy. You know, if you give me a choice, and I don't see myself as lazy, but if you give me a choice of the easy way or the hard way,
right,
I can't help it. I'm going to default to the easy
sure
way.
Wait,
Free money?
Free money.
I want it.
So, look, that my only concern, not my only concern, but my biggest concern with that kind of arguing is exactly what we discussed yesterday and just now. Once you say, okay, free money, the next question has to be, why not more? And that's the beef with the $5,000 surge in the middle class right now. How do you argue against that? You simply say it's not big enough.
A key House committee has approved Speaker Nancy Pelosi's sweeping drug pricing bill. The bill the House Energy and Commerce Committee approved Thursday evening would allow for Medicare to negotiate lower prices for as many as 250 expensive drugs each year.